You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
Thank you. Great job, guys. Thank you. Is everyone okay if I leave the mic off and just talk? If I talk at this voice level, pace, everyone okay? You guys in the back, good? Because I have a big mouth, so I'm probably pretty good at being able to talk. First of all, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you all. Secondly, I'd really like this to be an interactive presentation, so I will happily take questions during if it's right in line with the content. And if it isn't, I'll kind of ask that you hold that thought. Or if you're just more comfortable at the end asking questions, that's fine. I'll leave it up to you. But don't be bashful. I would prefer it be interactive than me getting up here and lecturing you, because I'm sure you do enough of that with your professors every day that you don't need to hear me lecture. I wanted it to be interactive, but I also wanted it to be a little bit insightful. So I thought I'd first start with me, you know, who I am and kind of where I came from and how I got to where I got to. So I was born on Valentine's Day in 1966. I know that's a long time ago for you guys. It felt like not a long time ago, not too many years ago. But I grew up in northern New Jersey. My father was a union carpenter. My mom was a secretary. No one in my family had gone to school other than high school. I had a younger sister. I have a younger sister. Grandparents from Italy, so my mom's side of the family is all Italian. I was really the first in my family to attend college, so that was kind of a big deal in my family. I went to a four-year school, but a medium-sized state school in Pennsylvania, Westchester University. I don't know how many of you have heard of it, but I really went there to play football. I played football in high school for Roxbury High School. Those of you that are from New Jersey or grew up here, northwestern New Jersey up in Morris County is Roxbury High School, pretty known for its football program. I played football there, graduated in 1984. Which I know sounds like a long time ago for you guys. But in any event, I really didn't know what I wanted to do when I left for college. And even in college, my first couple of years, I had no idea really what I wanted to do or what I wanted to be. And I was talking to some folks earlier before the presentation, and I would tell you all that this is the part of your life, your journey, to become ultimately where you want to get to and to be who you want to be. This is the part where you take it all in, right? Knowledge is power, particularly in this economy, in today's environment, right? Knowledge is everywhere. But how do you sift through all that, and how do you get that information so that it means meaningful to you? This is part of that, but continue to do research. And I will tell you that if you start that behavior when you're in high school and when you're in college of the voracious learner, right, someone who's constantly in search of new and better information, it'll stick with you for the rest of your life. And I will tell you, as the CEO of a $100 million company, I am in a constant learning mode. I don't have all the answers. I don't think I'll ever have all the answers. The world is too big. Our company is too big. We have 150 employees for me as the CEO to have all the answers. And I don't know if you get that yet, but I'm telling you, it's really important. It's really important. You will never have all the answers. You need to know where to go to get them, and that's part of what an education does for you. Went to grad school at St. John's. I pushed myself to get an MBA in finance because I'm not a finance guy. I really don't know finance. I do now. And I do because I own the company, and I was able to negotiate the ownership of the company. But I'm really not a finance guy. I'm probably more of a sales and marketing guy than I am a finance guy. But I learned a lot from pushing myself to get an MBA in finance. And why did I do that? Because I didn't know anything about finance, and I thought that that was going to be really important at some point in my career. Turns out it was. I started my career with Mobil Oil right out of college. Really great job, great entry-level management training program. They put us in company-owned apartments for a year. It was 24 of us. We were all right out of school from all different colleges and universities around the country. Some of those people are still my best friends. One of the guys was in my wedding. I mean, it was a really, really great experience. But what it taught me was to be ready for change, because one of the things at Mobil that was crazy, it was like the military, is you moved every year to 18 months. I mean, it was like the call of duty. You went to work for Mobil. They told you where you were going to be, and on a moment's notice on Monday morning, you needed to show up there. And so as these executives paraded around in this management program, they would come to me and say, you know, my name is Joe Smith. I've been with Mobil for 15 years, and I moved 14 times. My name is Jim Jones. I've been with Mobil. I'm this executive over here. I've been with the company for 20 years. I moved 19 times. And I got to the point where, you know what, I don't know that I really want to do that. I don't want to live the life of a military person having to move around everywhere like the military does to you. And mobile was very much like that. So pushed myself, got my MBA in finance, and looked around, found a job at Steelcase. Steelcase is the largest contract office manufacturer in the world. They're based in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where a lot of these office furniture manufacturers are from. It's just the nature of where they all grew up. Back 100 or so years ago when they started making furniture for corporations. And got the Steelcase and realized that I was on the wrong side of that industry. I wanted to be working for a distributor, a dealer, because that's really where the action is. So if you think of the automobile industry, you know, there's Ford Motor Company and your local Ford dealer. Very much a retail model, right? We all go in the front door and we buy Fords if we're so inclined. Or any other brand for that matter. Steelcase and the Steelcase dealer is more a business-to-business brand, and the folks on the introduction commented that we work with companies around the country. We work with big corporations like Johnson & Johnson, Novartis, Verizon, and we outfit their commercial interior space around the country, mostly here in the Northeast, but we do work for a lot of big companies around the country. And what we see and what I want to talk about today is the intersection between leadership through collaboration, which, by the way, is very different than leadership in your parents' generation, right? That sort of traditionalist mentality of the 50s and 60s and 70s, where hierarchy really mattered, right? Who you were and what role you had in the organization defined you. And I think what we're seeing now is really a fundamental change in business, right? It's not necessarily your position power. I stand here as the CEO of my $100 million company, but that doesn't make me a great leader just because I have the position power. In my own company, it's really a lot bigger than my position, right? It's about my skills, my capabilities, my voracious ability to continue to learn, right? And so why am I in front of you guys today? Because I want to be with students. I want to spend some time. Now that I've gotten to the point in my career where I own the company, I want to spend time with students because I want to continue to learn, and I want to understand from your perspective, what's new? What's happening? How are you guys going to come into the workforce? And what are you going to need that's different than guys like me that have been in the workforce for 20 years? And there is a difference. And with our partner, Steelcase, and some of our other manufacturing partners, we've studied that. And so what I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about leadership by collaboration from a very practical sense, right, from a business sense, and share some stories with you about how I've learned to be a better leader through and with collaboration, the collaboration of people. But I'm also going to then later kind of drive a little bit of an intersection to what we're seeing in corporations. And so what we do when we help clients outfit space is we study their culture. We understand a little bit about how they operate. We understand about how they communicate, how they collaborate, right, and how they're trying to go international if they're a medium-sized firm, or how they're already a multinational firm. How are they collaborating using technology, and how does the technology intersect with the space and the furniture that they're currently living and working in? And if you think about it in terms of, you know, your home, right, the home you grew up in, where do most people convene in the home? Anybody?
Kitchen.
Why? So food, sometimes an island, a space where everybody comes together. Right? And so that collaborative space, as simple as something like your home, the kitchen is a place where people come to collaborate, maybe do homework, have a quick conversation. If you're lucky enough to have an island or a little bar stool height table in your kitchen, that's where people come. And what you're seeing, Starbucks, right? How many people are across the street at Starbucks? I probably see half of you there because I'm there most of the time. Well, now you'll see me because now you see me up here. But, you know, it's the Starbucksification of the commercial office space. You know, lounge seating, collaborative spaces. It's no longer big private offices and a bunch of cubicles. So later in my presentation, I'm going to go for about an hour. It's a little 1:10, 1:12, so I'm going to go till 2 o'clock, start a little bit ago. So just to give you a sense of where we're at, that's what I'll do. And I'll leave time for questions. But honestly, if I see a hand raised, if I don't, raise it higher or yell. I'll be happy to answer questions about the content as we go through it. Any questions so far? This was the genesis of how I believe, honestly, and this sounds a little corny, how I got to where I got to and how I got to this fortunate place to own the company that I now own. This was hanging on my wall when I was like, you know, 9, and my parents put it there. And I'll let you read it. I'll read it to you because it's so important to me. You can if you think you can. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you like to win, but you think you can, it's almost certain you won't. If you think you'll lose, you're lost. For out in the world we find, success begins with your will. It's all in your state of mind. Life's battles are not always won by the person who is stronger or faster, and sooner or later, the person who wins is the person who thinks he can. And I fundamentally believe that. I'm a, you know, middle-aged guy, grew up in middle New Jersey in a middle-class family, the first one to go to college. I own a $100 million company. I can't believe I figured it out, but I did. I feel great about it. I feel very fortunate about it, and I feel the need to sort of give back and communicate with you all about how to do that, right? Because I fundamentally believe that I could. It almost starts with that. It's almost that simple. It really is almost that simple. This is another one that really resonates with me. Again, I'm going to read it because it's been so powerful to me. It's from Theodore Roosevelt. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the stronger man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that in his place shall never be with the cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. It's very verbose, very wordy, but in the end of the day, get in the game. Get in the game. Make mistakes. Fail. Trip up. I'm having a management meeting next week, and I bought everybody Neosporin, the little Neosporin you squirt on your hand when you get a cut, and I'm handing it out to the leadership team. And I asked my assistant to say, what do you do with Neosporin? Why the hell are you putting Neosporin? Because I want people to make mistakes. I want people to try. I want people to get cut. I want them to have a couple of bruises. Because if you don't have any cuts and you don't have any bruises and you haven't made any mistakes, you haven't learned. You haven't tried hard enough. So get comfortable with being uncomfortable and get comfortable with making mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, you're not trying hard enough. I've made a gazillion mistakes. That's how I got here. Quite frankly, I think now I'm making more right decisions than wrong, but I'm not sure sometimes. I just know I'm willing to make them. And you have to continue to make them and continue to push yourself. So buy yourself some Neosporin, put it on your cut when you get it, your business cut, and make some mistakes. But make it leaning forward. Make it failing forward, right? And by the way, you know, that never-ending saying, you know, don't make the same mistake 10 times because then that's just the definition of stupid, right? Don't do that. Don't do that. Learn from it. So where am I now? What does DS&D do? Very quickly, because I'll get into the meat of this. In the end of the day, this is what we do. We help companies foster their growth and their productivity by creating really great spaces where they work, where they learn, not really where they live, but where they spend their time in business, right? So it could be an education facility, could be a corporation, it could be a research facility, but these are spaces that we help create. And we look at it not from the furniture out, but we look at it from the building in, and we really take into account people and how people work. And if your kitchen wasn't your kitchen and you were trying to collaborate in your living room and you didn't have the right seating to do it and you didn't have a table and chairs to sit around, it'd be really tough to collaborate in your living room without any furniture, right? So we think about it much differently. We think about it broadly. And this just happens to be the building back in Lower Manhattan. The company started, believe it or not, in 1829. So I don't even know what generation I am as the owner, but it's gone through a couple of family generations. The Danker family owned it for a bunch of years. The Douglas family, DS&D stands for Danker, Salu, and Douglas. So I'm the first of probably four or five generations that hasn't been family. And so sometimes they say in a family business, you know, from shirt sleeves to, I forget the saying, but basically after the third generation, the business has failed. This one's gone through, I don't know, six or seven generations. 1829 is a really, really long time ago. And I've done some research on the company and the original owners, the Mr. Salu. He was the original roll-top desk manufacturer in Lower Manhattan on Fulton Street. So those old wood roll-top desks, they're actually collector's items. If you Google T.G. Salu roll-top desk, they're worth thousands of dollars. They're collector's items. We have a couple in our warehouse. Good so far? Any questions? Okay. So when you think about leadership, this is really where me and my team, and I have a leadership team, because to me, I'm the CEO, I set the stage, I set the tone for the company, but it really isn't all about me, it's about us. So I lead with us, I don't lead with me. There's no I in team. So I'm here representing myself, but I'm really representing the company. And I'm trying to give you guys some insight on where our leadership team plays, because my company is too big to run by myself. And that old model, you know, your father or your grandfather's model was the leader made all the decisions, everyone reported into the leader, and the leader decided pretty much everything. And that's when it was simple. Business isn't simple anymore. It's really complex. It's really fast. There are a lot of moving parts, and there's a ton of stuff happening now on a global level that affect us here in Somerville, New Jersey. I call our place Somerville, Raritan, New Jersey. So these are really the areas, and I used a ladder as kind of a metaphor for, are we as a leadership team in my organization, are we at the right altitude, right? Because we have managers and employees and we have supervisors that are responsible for implementing the things that we decide. But in the end of the day, leadership is really about these four key tenets. Anything I do during the day should fall into one of these four buckets, right? And the first one is talent. If you don't have the right people in your organization, or if those people aren't in the right roles, you got no shot. Talent trumps strategy every day of the week. It's all about people. Somebody was talking to me before. It's all about people. I finally learned that. It took me 15 years to learn that. We had the best strategy in the world. The wrong people can't implement. Can't do it. It's impossible. Talent trumps people. Talent trumps culture. Talent is first, because if you have the right people, like on a good team, a good football team, if you want to use my reference. If you have the right people, you can do anything. If you don't have the right people, the rest of it doesn't matter. And I can comfortably tell you that today, and I couldn't have done that even 5 years ago. So where do we focus our time? Talent. Do we have the right people? How do we assess that talent, right? And it's not just a gut, although that's part of it. There's a formal assessment process, right? Do they have the skills? Are they talented to grow and lead other people? Or are they talented as an individual contributor? Are they a content expert in their area, right? Two levels of talent. Not everyone can be the leader. Not everyone can be the CEO. Not everyone can be the manager, the general manager. But they were really good, and you need multiple disciplines within the organization of really good people that are good leaders and really good people that are, I'll call individual, what I said before, individual contributors. They're really, really good at something, and we need them to be really, really good at that. And so you have to ask yourself the question, what am I, right? Am I a leader of people in this room, or am I an individual contributor? I like to focus on one thing, and I do it really well. Every organization that you ultimately go out and land in someday needs both. Everyone needs both. And my job as the CEO, and I firmly believe this, and I think the newer leaders of organizations are believing this, is no better than the one that's the individual contributor. Because without him or her, I can't be effective if I don't have the right people in the right roles. So I don't see myself as the highest echelon in the organization. I see myself as one of a group of people that are helping run the company. And that's fundamental in how I operate, and I think it's really important that in this generation we operate that way. Culture. How do we do what we do, right? Culture matters, right? Performance matters, but performance is really about how we do things, right? I can hit my goals. We can sell as much as we want. We can have wonderful profits. But at the end of the day, if I do it and, you know, people are harmed by it, we're doing it the wrong way, right? And I say harmed in terms of, you know, we can really hurt people or do something wrong, then culture really trumps that. How do we do things in the context of how we decide we're going to do them? Performance. All about what we do, right? But in the context of culture, right? Performance, how well we do what we do, but do we do it the right way? Because it matters. The way you do things matters. And then strategy. So all four of these are really at the elevation, at the senior level of my organization and, frankly, most organizations. That's where the senior leadership team is focused. So I want to spend a minute diving into leadership and diving into this idea of collaboration within leadership. So let's take a look at, and I'm going to refer to this sort of traditional leaders and collaborative leaders. Traditional leaders, in my estimation or my view, the previous generation to me. You guys are the next generation from me, right? I mean, just take a look at age. So today we have, I think, four or almost five different generations in the same workforce. We have people in their 60s still holding on because their 401k is now a 201k. Hopefully it's back to a 401k soon. The economy is certainly picking up. And then we have millennials that are in the workforce and everywhere in between. So we have almost, for another couple of years, five generations in the workforce. You guys will be that next generation as the senior folks ultimately retire. But traditional, I'm referring to the generation previous to me, collaborative, kind of today's generation and hopefully in the future. So the concept, very simply, the workplace is changing, leadership is changing, the future is changing, and it is very much more collaborative. So I want to look at eight key areas, and these are the areas, and I'll just go through them really quickly. First one is power. Second one is information. The third one is idea generation. Fourth one is problem solving. Resource allocation, rules and responsibilities, resolving issues or conflict, and performance and feedback. So if we focus on these eight areas, I'm going to kind of walk you through where I think traditional leaders have been historically and where a newer collaborative type leader is emerging in many companies. Power. So this is the first one. I love this one. So everybody thinks in the old economy and in the old environment that power is all about your position. I'm the CEO, therefore I have all the power. And that may have worked in the 70s and 80s or the 60s and 70s, but really this is about power being a collective group power, right? And if you think about it, I have some charts up here. By the way, I'm a huge whiteboard guy in my own organization, so I greatly appreciate that. Come on in. Greatly appreciate that. That you guys have whiteboards here, because I can't talk without a pen and a whiteboard. My guys know that in the organization. So think about power, and think about three levels of power, right? The first level of power is this idea of position power. So position, spelled it wrong, position power. I am the director. I am the CEO. I am the, pick the, right? I am the teacher. I am the leader. So position power is, frankly, the least effective type of power. Anyone want to guess the second power? I cheated for myself here. Anyone want to, if you can see the little, it starts with an E. I don't know if you can see the E. You probably can't see that up there. The second power, expertise power. What's expertise power? I have an MBA. I am an attorney. I am a CPA. I am a doctor. Right? I have expertise power. I'm effective because of what I've studied or because of who I am or because of the content that I know. Right? What's the most important power? Anybody want to guess? There's a third one, so that's the most important. So I didn't tell you what it is yet. What do you think it is? Close. So you guys are nailing it, actually. You're damn close. That's really good. Personal power. Forgetting for a moment that power comes with authority, because in the old economy it did, right? The boss said so. It's really not about that anymore, right? And certainly in my organization, it's not about that. So don't get confused with who you are, right? We used to design spaces by how people, well, the CEO needs X amount. And the guys would come in, you know, guys like me in middle age would walk in and they'd count the ceiling tiles in their office to make sure they had, oh, this is a 10 by 15. I deserve this. This is really important. I need this giant private office. And, you know, Joe down the block, he's only a director. I'm a VP. Joe's only got six ceiling tiles. I got nine. I'm really hot shit. And that's what happened. I'm telling you, we deal with this every day in corporations, right? What they're focused on, position power. It doesn't matter. What really matters is what kind of influence you have on people. In the end of the day, what influence do you have on people? We all know in our groups, in a peer group, in school, that there's always that go-to person. Hey, what do you think? What do you think about this? Or someone that you just have a real trusted advisor, right? Someone in your family, perhaps, that you go to, that you go, oh, yeah, no, Uncle Bill's just really good at this stuff. I don't know. He's just a really good guy. Really has some really good insight. This is what it's all about. This isn't really necessarily trained. You don't train for personal power. You care. You care about people. You have a deep understanding of what's really going on in your world, right? It isn't because you've made it to CEO. It's because you really care and about the greater good and the collective group of teams. So keep that in mind. That's one of the big areas I wanted to make sure we hit on today, because that, to me, is really, really important. Any questions about that? Resonate? So a couple of head shaking. So information, right? So in the old economy, I have all the information, because clearly I have to make all the rules and I have to make all the decisions. So all the information is brought to me, the CEO, and I will tell everyone what to do. It doesn't work that way anymore. It just doesn't work that way, right? So it's all about information. By the way, I, in this old economy, if I had all the information, what happens today? I'll go to the internet and I'll dupe your information in 30 seconds and I'll show you that you're probably wrong, right? So in the end of the day, it isn't about holding the information. It's about constantly seeking and having the right people in the organization have the right information at the right time and be able to bring it forth, right? So in the end of the day, you have to have an organization that openly shares that information and that knowledge. And how do you do that? You gotta be in a learning mindset. The minute I think I have all the answers, my company's done. Close the doors. Because it's going to change, and I don't have all the answers. And whoever had the answer for today, tomorrow it's going to be different. And if I sat here 10 years ago and told you that, it might move at this pace. But now it's moving at this pace. It's freaking huge. It's flying through, and these decisions and information is changing quicker than we really know how to manage the change, right? Talking about big data. There's a lot of stuff in the news about big data. Big data is just that. It's really big, and people are trying to figure out how to manage it all and how to mine it for a business, for information, to improve, to beat competition. The only way you're going to do that is openly share and have the right people at the right information at the right time. It's really hard to do. Idea generation. Sometimes we listen to suggestion ideas from the team. Yeah, that's fine. That's what I do. But in the end of the day, I want to encourage suggestions, and I want to understand where people are coming from. I have another structure for you. I call these things structures. So if you think about your own learning, when you look in the mirror, right, and you have to learn about yourself before you can lead anyone else, you have to be able to lead yourself and understand yourself. And I keep saying look in the mirror, and it's all about figuring out who you are if you're going to have really great personal power. In the end of the day, you could be unconscious and incompetent. You could be conscious, incompetent. You could be unconsciously competent, or you can be, I'm not that tall, consciously competent. And what I mean by that is, here, you don't even know what you don't know. I have no idea. I didn't even know it existed. Oh my God, am I blind? I have no clue, right? Over here, I'm consciously incompetent. I know that there's a whole bunch of stuff I don't know about. That's a good sign because at least I know it's there. It's different because here I didn't even know it existed. So here I know it exists. I'm looking in the mirror and I'm trying to get a really good understanding of my incompetency. Where do I need to learn more? And at least I'm aware of it. That's, by the way, that's what school's about. That's what grad school taught me. Forget the MBA. It doesn't mean do. What really means MBA means is I know where to go for information and I'm constantly seeking new information. Went to school before cell phones, went to grad school before cell phones, did it while I was working full time, ran to the library, met with my friends, went to class at night, did all that stuff. But in the end of the day, it's really today. What do I take from it? Not the MBA that I have, the ability to know that I am sometimes consciously incompetent. I have an area that I don't know something about and I need to figure it out. I either need to bring the talent in, right, and bring them near me so I can understand it, or I need to go out and get it. Unconsciously competent. What is that? Anybody? Unconsciously competent. Think about it. What was the last thing you said? I'm sorry. You're able to. Okay. Very close. Good. Unconsciously competent. It's your raw talent. You don't even think about it. You're just good at it. People go by, oh, I can't believe you're really good at it. You're like, oh yeah, I know. I guess, I don't know. Right? You're kind of unconscious about your competency, right? Because you take it for granted because it's who you are. Then I'm exaggerating the unconsciousness of it, but the idea is it's really your strength, right? And when you explore that strength and when you really understand that strength, you can then go back and solve some of these things because you're willing to look at it differently, right? And ultimately, the last one is really the target, right? You want to be consciously competent. You want to know what you know most of the time. You never get there, ultimately, for every part of your career, your life, your business, but that's kind of the thinking about looking in the mirror and thinking about ideas and where you're going to get them. Problem solving. Ooh, the last structure. We're going to use this one, too. I forgot. Developing the approved solution for the team. So bring me your problems. I'll study them all, and we'll come up with the right solution. Then I'll tell you what it is. Old economy, new economy. How do we facilitate brainstorming? How do we get together as a group, and how do we take all this information and sift it out and make a decision? And I got to tell you, that's probably one of the hardest things in business is to get a group of people together. Get a group of people together and come to a decision. And I learned, again, another mistake. I used to make decisions by consensus. Everyone had to agree, and then we can move on. And guess what? Not everyone always agrees. I learned the hard way. It's just not going to happen. But people need to be heard. People need to feel like they've had a voice. People need to feel like they've had input, right? And so there's a structure for how to do that. First is data. I'm going to write this all out first. Information. Insights. Come back to that. Choices. Decisions. Action. A lot of people run to information. Impulse and comes. So we talk about big data, we talk about information, talk about a lot of the stuff that people do, and you know, how do you drive decisions? I have a leadership team of six of us together, the senior, as we call it, as I call it, the senior leadership team. And every day, well, every day, once a week we sit in a room for 2 hours, but every day we convene, but once a week we sit in a room for 2 hours, and we're really walking through information, trying to make decisions. So it starts with data, right? There's always data, there's always stuff, but data is just messy. It's just all over the place, and you can make whatever you want to make of it. So you need to turn that data into information. Right? What is that data telling us? And sort it so that I can understand it. Because data on its own could tell you anything. I mean, numbers could tell a story any way you want to tell a story. Right? I learned that in grad school too. But data is just that. It's only data. It's raw and it's ugly and it doesn't really do anything for you. Information now is like, okay, now I'm gleaning some stuff from the data. But really what I'm looking for, and this is the hard part, from this information as a team, what insights are we gleaning? What is this telling us? What is the information telling us, right? I said before, I used to lead by consensus, right? So, okay, everyone agree? Can everyone agree? Is everyone going to agree? Well, if everyone's not going to agree, we've got to keep working hard. Is everyone going to agree? It's not going to happen. What will happen is people feel like they get to weigh in this area, right? The information is giving us insights. Tell me your insight. I don't have to agree with it, but it might be interesting. It might be something that we have to take to a later point, something that we're going to use later. But from those insights, right, raw information to insights, this is telling me two or three or four or five things. Now I have some choices to make because I didn't just jump from data to action or data to information to action. By the way, this is impulse. It's really sloppy. Impulse. I have data. I have information. We have to make a decision. Left a couple people out, didn't really consider everybody, didn't get any insights or think about our choices, because there should always be a range of choices, right? But this data info, this is very impulsive. Here it's conscious, right? We're thinking through it. We're giving people a chance not necessarily to agree, but to weigh in and to buy in, because ultimately, once we figure out what our choices are, somebody has to be the tiebreaker. Somebody has to say, this is what we're doing, and sometimes that is my job. Now we make the decision, now we put it into action, and we go back and repeat it. So this is how you collaborate and problem solve by doing it in a structured way. And I only learned that 4 or 5 years ago. So that's free. You got that today. It's hard. You know, any of this stuff, the concepts are great. Put it in action. It's really hard. That's when the Neosporin comes in because you get cuts. It hurts. Resource allocation. Old way, allocate time and resources when I say so. New way, put the team in play, let them make the decisions, let them get involved, right? Every person, I use this in the firm, every person has superhero powers on my leadership team. I literally say, you guys have superhero powers. And what I did the other day, just by a quick story, is in this resource allocation, how do we enable my team, their teams, to get immediate time and resources? How do we define who's going to do what by when? because everyone on the team thinks they want to own everything. Remember, talent is an enterprise, right? Talent, strategy, culture, performance. Everyone wants to work on all those things, but some are better than others. Just like in this room, some of you are better at some things than others, right? You may know each other well or not know each other well, but if you knew each other even half well, you'd know who's better at what thing, whether it's your peer group or in information or this group. So what I did with my leader, and literally just yesterday, and I just because it was a quick story and it made a lot of sense, I literally went up on the whiteboard, because I can't help myself because I write on whiteboards, I put everyone's name across the top, there are six people, Bill, Kevin, Manny, Mary, and I wrote down like 8 or 9 things that they were really good at, and I asked them to rank their top five. It's probably 10 of each, and I asked them to rank their top five, because we were having some conflict, because we needed Neosporin, because we were in the throes of it, we were in the being marred and getting damaged and hurt by learning. And we were doing that and learning on the fly. And what was really cool about that was they all went up and circled those superhero powers, and frankly, they were all different. And what you saw in 5 or 6 leaders was, gee, you know what? Mary really is better at that. And why don't we let her take the charge there? Consequently, Kevin is really better at this. So that's an area where we really should lean on Kevin. And so it's not me making the decisions. It's the leadership team that's making the decisions. But if you just call it a team and you don't really know each other, like a good football team, if you don't know exactly what your partner or the guy next to you is going to do, play's not going to go very well. So it's really about getting close to your team and understanding really, really deep down who they are, really what they're good at, and challenging each other and being vulnerable with each other. And I started this thing by saying it's all about people. It's really all about people. It's really all about people. Rules and responsibilities. You know, in the end of the day, you're going to adhere to them, or we're going to allow them to evolve and fluctuate, right? So it's kind of like there's a rule or there's a guideline, right? At Starbucks, there's a guideline, right? They let you decide if you want to put something in your coffee, if the person wants to give you a free drink, if you're not happy with their drink, you can come back. Those are guidelines, right? If they have a set rule, you have to follow the rules. It's like, nope, the answer is no. I'm going to get fired if I change this or if I have to give you a refund. Some companies work that way, others don't. So this is really about put the rules or the responsibilities in the hands of the people and trust them. In the end of the day, it's about trust, right? It's about creating safety with your employees and with each other. You do that by being vulnerable with people and really understanding who each other are. You build some trust around that. And then our employees, make your decision, right? We're going to back you up. Don't make the same decision that's a bad one 6 times, but make a decision. And if it's in support of the customer, if it's in support of doing the right thing, it's your responsibility. Own it. Own it. Make the decision. We're going to allow you to make that decision. You're closest to it. You have the best information. I'm not. I wasn't there. What should we do? You decide. Old economy, I tell you the rules, you abide by them. It doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore. Resolving issues. Fires. Focus on the symptoms. Look at the root causes. So this is all about looking at yourself, right? In the end of the day, all of this is really about looking at ourselves as a company. You know, this idea that you're unconsciously incompetent, you're consciously competent, and you grow on it. It's a structure to say, have I really taken a good hard look at myself? If you can't, not if, you can't lead others, you can't be effective. And I don't mean lead as the CEO, I mean lead as really strong personal power. You can grow into the role of position if you need to be that, but it's really about leading through personal power, leading by being a really good person, having a lot of expertise. You can't do that if you're not looking at yourself. I belong to a group called Vistage. Vistage is a middle market CEO organization. I'm there with 18 other CEOs. We meet once a month for a full day. There's a woman that chairs the group. She's the chairperson of the group. And she is effectively a leadership coach. And those other 17 business owners, just like me, are sitting around a table. And I bring issues, things I'm struggling with, decisions that I have to make or have made, big decisions that I'm contemplating. And I bring that to the group. And we share and challenge and poke and prod each other. And they're some of my best business friends that I've ever had because they push and poke and prod me. And there's enough trust in the room. There's enough vulnerability that's allowed in the room that we can really push each other. And that's, in my estimation, the only way you get better. The only way you get better. So performance and feedback. You know, it used to be, I'm going to give you your performance review annually, and I'm going to tell you how you did. It's changing, right? Not that we're not giving performance reviews in business. We are. But there's this thing called kind of real-time feedback, right? It's not any new concept. It's just, let's be open and honest with people. Let's tell them where they stand right now, and let's tell them why they stand there. I've got a great story for you. This is, I'm really, really proud of. Our general manager realized that he had the wrong leader in a particular group, a group of administrators. And this woman was in her mid-50s, late-50s, and she was leading a group of administrators. And she was nasty, a little arrogant, not really happy doing what she was doing, and her people knew it. And it had really was having a negative effect on productivity and performance of the group. And, you know, at first we were sort of contemplating what the problem was and, you know, should this woman be terminated? Should we do something else with her? And I give a lot of credit to our general manager who sat her down and had a very open and honest conversation with her about, do you really like what you're doing, right? Are you just focused on the position power of being the boss? You're the manager of the department, so therefore you're really important. Or have you thought about doing other things in the company? And remarkably, she was, like, relieved at the conversation. It's like the air just kind of came out of her whole body. She said, God, I thought you never asked. This job isn't for me. I don't really want to lead this group. It's hard work. I'm not good with people. I avoid conflict. I got here because you needed me to be here 7 years ago, so I took on the responsibility. But you know what? I just don't want to do it anymore. I just don't want to do it anymore. She could have got fired if we didn't have that conversation with her. She happily stepped down, stepped aside. She became a content expert, and we hired someone that wants to lead people and is really good at leading people. And so this woman that was the leader steps aside, doesn't get a salary bump or change, doesn't really affect it. I mean, that's kind of how we operate. And she steps in and now is the real confidant and support person for this new manager that's going to own the group and be responsible for the group. That doesn't happen unless you have dialogue, communication, open vulnerability, that you're really open and honest with people. And it's really hard to do because you've got to know people on an intimate level. So I want to take the last 15 minutes or so. Before I do, any other questions about anything? I wanted it to be interactive. I still feel like I'm up here chatting away, but at some point you guys may have questions. I was trying to get you involved a little bit before. But any questions, any thoughts, any comments so far? Anything you're confused about? Yeah. The cons is it's hard. It's hard. It takes more time. The con is it's listen, if a fire is burning in a building and the firemen are all there, they don't need a collaborative meeting to figure out what to do, right? So there are certain things in any organization that you just have to go do, right? You can't spend a lot of time thinking about. But those are really the tasks, right? Those are the things that just have to get done. And they're structured and they're meaningful, like putting out a fire in a burning building. So everyone understands those. But when you're talking about what to do or you're working on the business and not in the business, that's when collaboration has to play. And it's harder. The drawback is it's harder. I could sit in my office and make all the decisions. It'd be easier. It wouldn't be better. It wouldn't be a better output or a better outcome for the company. It'd be certainly a lot easier. I have another structure for you, if it helps. A leader and a manager is, in my estimation, you have lead, manage, and do. Right? And that is kind of how it breaks out. So as a leader, you're spending all your time on the business. This is on and in, and this is in. And this is all about on the business, is all about resource allocation. So the difference between a true leader and a line manager, leadership is about the right altitude. Are you working at the right altitude for the company? And are you thinking about resources, people, time, money, big resources, and are they allocated appropriately? And do we have the right people on the right seats in the bus? as a manager, that's already been determined for the most part for you, and now you're driving the bus down the road. And as a doer, right, just an employee, you're on the bus in a chair providing a function, and your job is to do whatever that function is. But the leader is determining, in this analogy of the bus, where the hell are we going, right? I know we're on the bus and we're driving down the road and the manager has the steering wheel and she or he is driving the bus with all the people in it that are doing their jobs, but are we on the right road? Or where exactly are we going, right? Didn't we say we were going, well, I think we're taking the wrong route, guys, right? So leadership is about on the business. It's about where are we going, not necessarily driving the bus. Get the analogy? Okay. Other questions? We have another 10 minutes. Good information from bad information. I think it's through the rigor of the insights, right? So it's a debate. It's never usually in the debate. So I lost that structure. But, you know, data and then information, insights. So what is that information telling us? Can we really draw an insight from it or not? If we can't draw an insight from it, the data, the information isn't so good. So go back and get more information. Go back and get better information. Because there are times when you look at data, information, insights. There are times you look at information and go, I don't know, that's not enough. You know, that's just one little piece. What about this group? Or what about a broader? Let's go back and do some more research. Right? Because we don't have enough to tell us what our real insights are. So it's really just that debate. And, you know, usually it's with, in a collaborative, it's usually with more than one or two people, three or four maybe, where you're really debating, is it really the right information? And if not, you got to go back and get more information, more data to make more, to get better insights. Part of that is how you sort it, too, and how you think about it, right?
You were talking about failing forward and making mistakes. What's a time when you made a mistake, and what did you do to fix it?
Oof. I got a bunch of those. The biggest mistake that I made in the last couple of years, and it had an enormous negative effect on the company, we acquired another company, our direct competitor, in New Jersey, and there were two owners who were brothers, and they in the acquisition they needed employment, so their company wasn't doing well. We acquired them, and we gave them employment as part of the acquisition, so they had an employment contract, and they were senior people. Obviously, they owned the company, so we made them part of the leadership team because it just made sense to make them part of the leadership team. So we had the Hatfields and the McCoys come together because we competed for two generations. Their fathers, actually Scott Douglas of Danker, Sloan Douglas, Scott's father and their father competed back in the 60s and 70s. So we brought the Hatfields and the McCoys together and said, okay, we're going to create this great leadership team. And we tried to climb up the mountain together. And I successfully really screwed up the culture of the company over a 4 or 5 year period because fundamentally, both of them, as previous owners, didn't really want to work for me and really didn't have the same ideologies, the same philosophy, the same culture as we had. And so we had two factions of the company. We had kind of the Steve faction and the other faction. And I allowed that to exist and ignored it for a while. And I had all the signs that it wasn't going well, but had made a commitment in the acquisition to their employment. And at the end of the term of the employment. Actually, a year before the end of the term, I actually terminated this person's contract and paid them, took the high road, paid them the balance of their contract, but they're no longer with the company, and that set us back probably 4 or 5 years because it was very disruptive, very disruptive. It's all about people. So I have a few more slides. I'm just going to cruise through these in the last 5 or so minutes. Living in a Great Reset is a great book, by the way. You know, this is the Great Reset. We're living in it. So things are different, right? And I want to give you a sense, and this is where I kind of admit the cross-section between leadership and what I do or what we do for a living, right? The webification of life. You know, in offices today, everyone's walking around with this device that has all kinds of information on it, and the web is available 24/7 because everyone has Wi-Fi in the building. You know, the output is different. So do we have the right spaces that help communicate, collaborate, creativity, and innovation? Stressors are different, right? 11 million bits of information every second, but we can only process 40 bits of information. So this is my backup to my hypothesis of new leadership, okay? Employees are twice as likely to report their work environment as stressful, right? This is a satisfaction survey at Steelcase where it looks about employee engagement, right? Think of it, you know, at Raritan Valley here. Are you engaged in your learning or are you just going through the motions? Same in business, right? Are you engaged in your job or are you just going through the motions? Companies like mine want everybody really engaged, right? Or big companies like J&J. So dissatisfied, highly dissatisfied, dissatisfied, somewhat satisfied. So only 20, 31% are really satisfied or highly satisfied in their work, in their environment. Big article in the New York Times, everyone hates their work, the cubicles of the world, right? That's kind of going away. Individual versus collaborative. Individual workers, 54%. Collaborators, 46%. Here's the amount of time collaborators spend with one person. Here's the amount of time they spend with 3 to 6 people. When you collaborate, here are different types, right? Informal, unstructured. We just bumped into each other in the hallway, and we're now working together on something real quick. 25%, we're generating activities. And then this is formal. We have a meeting. We're sitting down. We've planned it. We've scheduled it. 86 to 98 minutes, the amount of time lost when you're not engaged, when you're not satisfied, when you just aren't really playing. It's a cool video. Oop, let me go back. Give you a sense of what the spaces we design look like. Hopefully this is where you're going to work. I'm going to stop here. Any questions? What'd you think? Feedback. When you go to work, how do you want to work? Effectively. That's good. What's important to you? I mean, this is a little bit of my research, right? Informal research with you guys. What's important about work when you get out into the workforce? What's important to you?
Not feel like a job
to enjoy what you do.
Like the people you're working with?
Be empowered to
do
what you do. Make money. When you think of, just go ahead.
I guess making some sort of difference in whatever it is you're interested in.
Okay. How do you guys work, even here? How do you work individual versus groups? How many are more comfortable in a group? Just by raise of hands, show of hands. How many are more comfortable individual? All right, so it's a pretty even split. Yeah. Anybody else? Anything else? Any questions about anything we covered?
In research and development, can you create new furniture? Where do you get your insights and ideas?
Good question. So the question was, in research and development, where do we get insights and ideas for new products? My company typically relies on the manufacturers, but the manufacturers do a ton of research. One of the cool things they do, which is really interesting, is this thing called video ethnography. So they take small little video cameras and they place them in rooms in corporations and see what's working and what's not working in the room. So literally, time-lapse photography, watching the ants, us, all the people, right, walk around and, you know, have to plug in their laptop, or how do they get access to information, or how do they... And what you see is, like, you know, okay, so there's a technology connection problem, or there's a screen problem, or there's a... People don't feel like they can collaborate and move around the space the same way. And so when they think about furniture, it's really a lot of industrial anthropologists. It's almost like, how do people in business think, act, and move through the space? And they've come up with a lot of cool... I'll just show you one real quick. This is a product that was an evolution of that video ethnography, right? So it's called MediaScape, and this little puck you plug right into your laptop, and now you can display information, you can do video conferencing, and it's literally not a connection. I mean, it's a connection, but these pucks can be user changed and can display what's on the screen. So we could be, take a look at this. And you could have 6 screens, 8 screens and split all the information. And so displaying the technology so that you can use it and be meaningful as you're working is important. Just some other cool stuff. Yeah, and from our world, this is, you know, big workplace issues. How do we optimize real estate? How do we enhance collaboration of the teams? How do we attract, develop, and engage people? Right? How do we build brand and culture? And then how do we create well-being? And you've heard kind of through all those today. So that's what we do. That's the intersection of both. Yeah. I think there are, well, one thing I would tell you is that the previous owner effectively made himself irrelevant. Sounds weird, right? The owner of the company, my predecessor and my former partner, effectively made himself irrelevant. So as the senior most person and as the owner, he worked himself out of a job, stepped out of the seat, sold his company, and now the company is able to operate as he's in Connecticut and Florida and joined himself at 60 years old, which is relatively young to retire these days. And so I think that's probably the most profound thing I learned from my former partner was in those kind of formative years for me as the new guy kind of coming through the organization. Where is he and how come he's not here helping and how come he's not involved? And I, at some point in the latter part of my formative years, kind of felt like I was doing all the work. Where the hell was he? And he was professionally making himself irrelevant so that the company could operate without his involvement, and that's the ultimate in leadership, and he learned a lot from that. So that was how he prepared the next generation. And by the way, he did that because it was the right thing to do, but he also did that because in our type of businesses, the succession plan and how you kind of how you get your value, your dollar, you know, I mean, in the end of the day, he owned a $100 million company, and that's worth something. How he got that out was through the hard work and effort and leverage of these guys, which is now me. So I own the company, just like when you own a house and you have a mortgage. I own the company, and I'm paying down the former owner for his sayonara, his sale, right? So he put himself in a position where he's now getting paid to not, you know, he's getting his value out of the company, and he's not here. And he's built the company so well that he's able to step out and rely on me to make sure he gets paid. And we're kicking the debt in the shorts. I mean, in 2 years, we've paid 68% of the debt down already. So it's pretty good.
In the furniture business, what would you say your percentage of market shares?
So in this region, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, we, just our company, and there are others that do what we do in this region, we have about an 18% market share. In New Jersey, it's probably 25%. New Jersey alone. So we're amongst our competitors, we're a market leader in New Jersey. And there's some industry standards that measure that, so I'm not making it up, but we have some data in terms of sales. Yeah. I think the first thing is every client's different. So if you devise a client strategy, it shouldn't be a broad strategy. It'd be very specific. And I think the other thing, at least in our business, is meet them where they are, right? Really, if you really understand their business, you know, our best salespeople are not salespeople. They're consultants of the client, where the client has brought them in and helped engage them in helping solve their problem. And that to me is creating the best experience, right? So it's not in our industry, right? Business to business, big capital expense. Our average sale is probably $200,000 or $300,000, and a decent project for us is a couple $1 million. So we work in big capital expense space, not widget sales. And for us it's really about, and this is not true of all businesses, for us it's about that partnership, that relationship, and trust. And when they trust us, and when we're acting in their best interest, and we're forward-thinking for them, that's their best experience, right? It's not, there isn't a, it isn't gimmicky. You know, some other businesses are gimmicky. You know, buy one, get one free. You see a lot of retail gimmicks. Our business isn't that way. Some are, and some are effective that way, but ours isn't. I think I'm pushing on my time limit, am I? Okay. Guys, thank you very much. Really, really appreciate your time. Cool. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Awesome.